From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar.
And this week, we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org.
Eric, welcome back.
Hey, Don. Thanks for having me back. Glad to have you back home from that Cleveland trip that you stomached in sacrifice to us all.
It was interesting as hell. Certainly suffering through a political convention is quite an effort. Also, you know, the security means you have to do a lot more walking. When you're carrying equipment, it's a real hassle.
You're carrying the equipment and you are carrying the cross for all of us.
Oh, thank you so much. All right, let's talk turkey.
Yeah, it's been a while since we spoke, and you know, the situation there, man, it moved quickly. So I don't know if it's necessary for us to
Let's do an outline, you know, let's do a factual outline. I mean, not necessarily a minute by minute timeline, but a little bit of input into the event, a description of the event, and then an analysis.
Okay, so basically Erdogan goes on a brief vacation. He leaves the capital. While he's gone, there is a coup by certain elements within the Turkish military. It's not 100% clear exactly who was involved. We know who's been arrested for being involved, but that's a huge segment of nearly every institution of the Turkish state, including military, police, judiciary, academia, and so forth. So those who have been arrested for it and the sort of purges that have followed this failed coup, that's one thing. But in terms of who was actually involved, you had key figures in the military hierarchy, including some top generals in the Air Force and others. And it seems, at least the information that's come out, that a lot of the coup was orchestrated and or organized from the Incirlik base, which is quite interesting, considering not only that that's not just a Turkish military base, that's a NATO military facility, and it houses a significant number of U.S. military forces, and well, we can speculate who else might be there. But right. In any event, so you had elements of the military that carry out this what seemed like, as we were watching it unfolding, and in the hours afterwards, what seemed like a very poorly organized coup. I mean, one that, you know, they seized a couple of bridges and two of the three airports, but that was about it. I mean, the tanks came out. There was
a lot of people said, let me just interrupt you. A lot of people said that the sloppiness of it was evidence that it wasn't backed by the U.S.
Well, I'm going to get to that argument because I don't actually agree with that.
Nor do I, but it is, it's an amusing argument, if nothing
else.
Yeah,
the idea that the U.S. couldn't have been behind it because it failed and was a disaster. Right. I wouldn't agree with that. But although it's a valid conclusion that some people have drawn, and I do want to discuss it because I think it's important. In any event, so the coup happens, you know, a couple of things that I found interesting as I was watching this all evolving. Number one, they didn't seize the TV stations and the news media stations, which I thought was pretty interesting, considering considering the fact that any coup that's going to be successful really needs to basically take control over all forms of communication.
He's been moving towards that for a good long period, though, which is why I was also surprised that he didn't, like, you know, clinch that before they moved, you know?
You mean who?
Well, Erdogan has been moving towards taking over the media generally. It's Gulen that's controlling the media, and it's, you know, anti-Turk, all this stuff. It's the Kurds that are, you know, terrorists are being supported by the media. He's been shutting them down, and you would think that the coup would be at least mindful of the fact.
And
yet they, you know, I mean, look at, what did they do in Venezuela, for example, when they tried to oust Chavez? That's an example of a U.S.-styled coup, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly right. That's, I agree with you. So, you know, so they didn't seize control of the TV stations. They didn't really seize control of all, I guess what we could call, you know, points of egress, you know, out of the Capitol. I mean, a couple of the bridges and so forth. But again, it looked like it went off sort of half-cocked, you know, and that was my initial sort of interpretation of it. And I think that as we get further into sort of our analysis of all of this, I think it's going to be a little bit more clear, at least what my, let's call it my hypothesis is as to why it looked like it went off half-cocked. So in any event, that's the way that the events happened. And then Erdogan basically gets on, was it via like FaceTime or something like that, you know, via his phone, right, broadcast to the country, calling his supporters out into the streets. They're out into the streets. They confront some of the tanks in the streets with some pretty powerful images that we saw, you know. Again, you know, since you brought it up, I kept thinking back to 2002 in Venezuela. Now, I wouldn't say you had the mass outpouring for Erdogan exactly to the extent that you had for Chavez in 2002. Right. But certainly people power was on the streets. It was evident Erdogan's political machine and the base of support that they do have, which is obviously significant. I mean, he is, you know, he's been elected multiple times. The AKP party is in firm control, so that shouldn't have really come as too much of a surprise. So anyway, the coup ultimately fails, you know, and interestingly, the U.S. had very little to say in those hours that were, you know, oh so critical. They were not out there condemning the coup as being an assault on democracy, which obviously implies, at least to some degree, that if they didn't orchestrate it, then at the very least they were supportive of it to some extent. Yep. And then obviously once it became clear that the coup was failing, only then did we have any statements from Washington about democracy, about you know, this and that, and these sorts of issues.
And so, cautious words at that. I mean, they were still anticipating maybe it'll turn out different and this has to fit that situation.
And
too,
one can understand, right? I mean, you can understand they were hedging their bets. They wanted to see how it was going to play out. So, I mean, it's not something that's, you know, unknowable. I think it's pretty interesting to think about the fact that the U.S. in many situations would have been the leading edge of condemning and or supporting something. I mean, remember the U.S., how long did it take them to support the coup in Venezuela in 2002? Like 37 minutes or something like that?
I think they actually
already recognized Carmona and the coup government.
I think they actually did it before he had assumed, you know.
I mean, it was literally like almost instantaneous. And so, you know, that obviously raises a number of questions. But anyway, so Erdogan's supporters come out into the streets. The coup is beaten back and Erdogan survives this. And now in the days after the coup, you see massive purges, political purges on a very large scale taking place in Turkey. And again, when we say this, we have to be clear. We're not talking about purging just the Turkish military. This is literally a purge of every state institution. As I mentioned earlier, you know, it's the military, but it's also academia. It's also the media. It's also, you know, the judiciary and nearly every significant state institution.
Yeah, this is something that's been ongoing, by the way. And now he's, you know, certainly capitalizing on this. Obviously. Yeah, right. Yep.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You're absolutely right. And, you know, it's interesting. I when this all happened, I reposted an article that I had published a year ago called "Has Turkey Become a Fascist State?" And you have a significant shift towards the right under Erdogan that is ongoing. And this coup is in many ways accelerating a lot of these processes. So, you know, I can remember it was very, you know, just a very short time ago, Turkey was the champion of human rights and the champion of Europe and desperately wanting to be, you know, part of the European, you know, the European cool kids club. And here we are in, you know, the summer of 2016. Not only has Turkey abandoned that, but Turkey has gone in the complete opposite direction and has accelerated these politically motivated purges. And that's really what they are. And I think that's how they need to be understood. Now, let me just clarify or you know, add a point to that analysis. I am not suggesting by any stretch of the imagination that, you know, Erdogan is the good guy here, or, you know, that Erdogan is the bad guy here, or anything like that. All I'm saying is that the practical reality of what we're seeing is a coup fails, and Erdogan has seized the moment, seized the opportunity to not only consolidate power, but to carry out these broad and sweeping political repressions that he probably couldn't get away with under normal circumstances. And so we need to be clear about what we're seeing in this moment. And now that he's declared this sort of 3-month national emergency, state of national emergency, what does that mean? I mean, looking like nationwide political repression that's going to go on for at least 3 months, where more or less, we can imagine we're going to see rooted out of all of these different institutions of the state anyone who opposes the AKP, that's Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, and specifically it'll be an attack on the network of Fethullah Gulen, the U.S.-backed billionaire who's here in Pennsylvania, who many in Erdogan's camp charges being responsible for the coup or being involved in the coup. And so I guess maybe now would be a good time to just reiterate to people the basic landscape, the political landscape as far as the factions go. You have one faction around Erdogan, that's the Justice and Development Party, the AKP. They are of the milieu of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood, really this sort of political Islamist vision that they espouse. That is, in effect, what Erdogan is, and that is sort of where his power base is located. The second faction that is of relevance here is the Kemalists, the secular, oftentimes military power that in many ways sees itself as the guardian and custodian of the legacy of Ataturk, the founder of the Turkish Republic. Ataturk and the secularists, who have really kind of militantly crushed any form of political Islam for decades. They are deeply connected to the US and NATO. They have been for decades. They are long tied to the CIA and to US intelligence, the MI6 and, you know, the other Western intelligence agencies. And we have seen this play out a number of times, including, you know, similar coups in previous years. I wrote an article that was that, you know, that's out there floating around now called Erdogan's Checkmate. What exactly did I call it? I forget. I'll get it in a second. But in any event, the point that I'm making here, let me give you the title. Erdogan's Checkmate, CIA-backed coup in Turkey fails, upsets global chessboard. That's my article that was published 2 days ago. So anyway, the Kemalist faction.
Where can people that want to follow that?
Sure. You can get that article on my website, StopImperialism.org, and as of Monday, it will be published on Counterpunch as well.
Okay, go ahead.
So, yeah, and you can find all my stuff on my website, Stop Imperialism, and or on Counterpunch. So anyway, you have the secular Kemalists, right? And their power generally lies in the military. And then the third faction you have is the faction that is really around this guy Fethullah Gulen, who is this billionaire religious teacher, imam, who is the power behind probably the world's largest single charter school and private school network. I mean, he is behind a network of schools globally that really stretches quite literally the entire world, from the United States to Europe to, you know, Central Asia to, you know, all parts in between. And Gulen is, well, It's an open question, I think, for some people exactly where his loyalties lie. Erdogan and Gulen came up essentially together as far as their political lives, because they are both of the political Islamist orientation. And so in many ways, they were kind of being pushed by certain elements in the U.S. intelligence community in the late 90s and in the early part of last decade, the early part of the 2000s. And basically they came up and sort of got to power together in a sense, but have since had a major falling out. Since then, Gulen has been tried in absentia in Turkey, convicted of numerous crimes, and it's part of the reason why he will not be returning to Turkey, why he's sitting on an estate in Pennsylvania.
In the Poconos, the scenic Poconos.
Yeah, the very scenic and beautiful Poconos. What are you, sponsored by the Poconos Tourism Authority?
Not yet, but I'm hopeful.
Sure. Well, dream big, my friend. So there is this question about Gulen and Gulen's networks, because he has managed to penetrate quite literally all of the state institutions. So you have Gulenists in academia, Gulenists in the media, Gulenists in the in political offices, Gulenists in the police forces, and military, all of that. So there is this sort of machinations that are happening behind the scenes here that we really need to take into account when we do an analysis of what happened in Turkey, because the question now becomes, what really happened and who was supporting what, and you have these sort of competing theories here. And it's my contention that more or less what happened is actually knowable. Now, we can't know all of the details. We don't know every single thing that happened, but some of the elements we do know, and what we can say for certain is that there is clear and unmistakable collaboration between Gulen and the CIA. This we know for certain. We can point to specific and critical evidence, such as Gulen's relationship with Graham Fuller. Graham Fuller, quite a notorious, higher up in the CIA. He was one of the main CIA executives, I guess we could call him. He was deeply involved in pushing the very notion, including the very term was his, quote, moderate Islam, right? That is a Graham Fuller term, and Fethullah Gulen was sort of the epitome of Graham Fuller's concept of moderate Islam. He's since written books about it, and what's interesting is Graham Fuller actually, we're talking a major CIA player, not just an agent. We're talking like one of the highest ranking CIA officials, who is now, who in 2006 wrote letters in support of Fethullah Gulen's application for a green card to the United States.
Really?
And it wasn't just Graham Fuller. So did Morton Abramowitz. Now, Morton Abramowitz's name might be familiar to some people. Not only was he CIA station chief in Turkey, he was the U.S. ambassador to Turkey. So you're talking to probably the two single most important, powerful, and influential American intelligence figures in Turkey who both write letters in support of Fethullah Gulen's application for essentially what amounts to asylum in the United States. Now, that is pretty interesting. I think in almost any situation, if you had two high-ranking CIA officials speaking in support of somebody, we could draw a pretty clear conclusion as to who that somebody might be or where their loyalties might lie. Yeah. And that was not that long ago. Again, that was 2006, so we're talking 10 years ago that this happened. And so in the intervening period between then and now, you have seen the Gulenist network expand significantly, including penetration of a number of media outlets in Turkey, which more or less disseminate the Gulenist line. Now, Gulenist line might not always be untrue. A lot of what they say about Erdogan is true.
Right.
A lot of what they say about Turkey is true. But that's not the point. The point is the penetration of these institutions. People in high-ranking, influential, important positions whose loyalties are to Gulen, who answer to Gulen. And that's part of the reason why the state, the Turkish state, and Erdogan immediately put Gulen's name out there. I mean, this was not a surprise to anybody. So, pulling back from all of that, just to kind of lay sort of the picture here, you have these three factions, Erdogan, the Kemalists, and Gulen. The question is, who were the coup plotters and who were they associated with? Well, obviously, they were associated with groups 2 and 3, the Kemalists, the military, and the Gulenists. Now, my question would be, is there overlap there? Are some, kind of in both camps? Are there secular Kemalists who are also kind of in bed with the Gulenists? Are they maybe working for Gulen, working with Gulen. There are connections between U.S. military and NATO intelligence and the Kemalists, and between U.S. intelligence and Gulen.
And so, Erdogan, too, by the way.
And Erdogan, of course. I mean, that
that's
right.
Institutional, that stuff, too.
Yeah, exactly. So you're right. I shouldn't say it, I was going to say it goes without saying, but no, we should say that. Erdogan has long ties as well. And although Erdogan's ties are a bit more complex because they're sort of through the medium of the Muslim Brotherhood, and so he has sort of this
like a Saudi interlocutor, basically.
And also, he kind of, I guess, what can I say? He's sort of on the same page with the U.S. at times and totally doing the opposite at other times. That's part of the reason why Erdogan is such an, I guess, from the Washington perspective, an unreliable partner, because he's not really doing what he's told the way that most, U.S. proxies are supposed to do. He's doing more or less what he thinks is going to improve his own position, which is not always aligned with the U.S. agenda. Right. So, anyway, that's sort of the nature of the coup. And so, as I mentioned, Gulen has these ties to the CIA, to U.S. intelligence. Now, we also have very clear information about the fact that Erdogan made a major move to secure the base at Incirlik. That was one of the first things that was done. Yeah. And the reason I would contend, and again, this is my conclusions that I'm drawing from this. The reason for that, I would contend, is twofold. One is the publicly stated reason, namely that the generals and those in command at Incirlik were involved in the coup, and so they were to be arrested.
Right.
I think that's pretty clear, pretty obvious, and predictable. The second issue, though, is that Incirlik is a major bone of contention between Erdogan's government and the United States, because Erdogan wanted to exercise what we might call expanded sovereignty over the base at Incirlik. He wanted the Turkish government to be able to be the final word on all things that happen at Incirlik. In other words, if the U.S. wants to run a sortie into Syria to conduct a bombing campaign, they have to clear it with Turkey first. Right. Well, you can imagine how well that went over in Washington, like a lead balloon, So that was obviously one of the major points for Erdogan, was seizing control of Incirlik to both crush the coup, but also to assert control against the Americans. Remember, we have at least 2,500 Americans at Incirlik.
Right.
Okay.
And let me interject here, because that also could indicate something. It might indicate that his perception is that the U.S. was involved in this and he was locking them down.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Yeah. That's 100% right. Yeah. I totally agree with that. I think that part of asserting control over the base is basically saying that this was the locus of control of the coup.
Right.
That the jets that were strafing on the streets of Ankara, that those jets, they came from Incirlik.
Right.
That Incirlik is the home of some of the key military hardware that without which there could be no coup. So part of it was to lock down the coup, and part of it was to lock down the people who were there who might be involved in the coup. Now, I think the real point here is that Erdogan was kind of signaling in that moment right there that he believes that the United States is behind the coup.
Let me ask you a question, because the first thought that I had, and I've since questioned it, because this is just so ridden with contradiction, was that it was one that I had when he made the, at least public relations, attempt at a rapprochement with Russia. The first thought I had in my head was, geez, how long is it going to be before the coup? And then when I heard there was a coup in Turkey, and I heard it late, I got up, because I was preparing to go away and all this. When I heard that, I was like, oh, damn, they only waited like a week and a half.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly right. I thought the same thing.
I mean, facially, it looked like that.
I mentioned this in my article that is one of the major issues. Now, it's not, I don't think that the United States necessarily cares whether Erdogan issues an apology. What they care about is what the symbolic significance of that apology is.
Or perhaps the material significance of what might be coming, because, you know, this is a... Turkey is a key swing in geopolitics there. If Turkey were suddenly an ally, but now, I mean, there's never been any... First of all, you've never had the intensity of, like, you know, focal point, perhaps, for World War III with Turkish NATO planes shooting down a Russian plane, for example. You know, it's really hot there, in other words, with Syria and everything. And he had taken this position in November by shooting the plane down, and suddenly looks like he's backing off of it. And, you know, just... If there were, and this, who knows what was really motivating it, but if this were signaling a switch and leaning towards Moscow, it's huge geopolitically. That's all I'm saying, is the scale of the possibility is huge.
Well, that's exactly what I would contend as well. That's part of why the last part of my title of my article was upsetting the global chessboard. Because
right,
I think that ultimately that's exactly what we're seeing. Yeah. And that, you know, we don't normally see major geopolitical swings happen literally overnight. But I think that's exactly what we've seen with Turkey. And now, certainly, there's definitely a lot to be said for the fact that we don't know whether this is really going to, you know, materialize in a on the long-term scale, but it certainly appears, based on everything we've seen and based on the fact that Erdogan is pushing forward with very, very wide-ranging, sweeping political purges, that he believes that this is sort of the, you know, that he's essentially crossed the Rubicon with the West, you know, that he's essentially gone and completely committed himself to a non-Western aligned political calculus. Now, what does that actually mean? Well, I think that number one, it means that Erdogan has finally let go of the complete fantasy of regime change in Syria. I think that that means that Erdogan is prepared to do a deal with the Russians. I think it means that Erdogan is prepared to concede that he'll never get his proxy government in Syria, that he needs to find a solution to that problem, and that the only solution that the road to that solution runs through Moscow and Beijing, not through Washington, at least for Turkey. Now, there are a number of other questions, though, that we really do need to bring up.
Before we go there, let me flesh out a little bit that part of the landscape, because Orwell said, you know, 1984, the object of power is power. Okay, yeah. So there's that driving his attempt to, you know, create a totalitarian condition with him at the top, or however you want to characterize it, but that word generically applies. You know, trying to get control of the media, the courts, you know, everything, absolute control. That could be just an end in itself, but it also may be looking to have levers of power in order to effect such a shift, so that if there's a protest from some segment of the Turkish population, as there likely will be, against reorienting policy towards Moscow, that he's setting up the preconditions for it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Let's put it this way, that in order to reorient the foreign policy and geopolitical reality of a country as embedded in the Western system as Turkey is, I mean, remember, this is a NATO partner. This is a member, not just a partner, a member of NATO, and one that played a critical role in NATO all through the Cold War.
Let's say the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example. That was the swap-out position for the missiles in Cuba, where the NATO missiles in Turkey.
Exactly. So Turkey has really played a pivotal role in NATO all through the Cold War. And so there is this question that, you know, if you were a leader in a country like that, and you wanted to reorient your foreign policy and reorient your entire, you know, strategic position toward, you know, away from US and NATO and towards the non-Western world, if you wanted to do that, you would by definition have to control the political, economic, and most importantly, social, cultural, and communications architecture, right, or infrastructure. In other words, you can't do that unless you can control the messaging that goes out. And the only way that you can do that is if you control the media. And that's, again, where we come back to Gulen, because Gulen and his people are deeply embedded in the Turkish media, really all throughout the media, including certain very important media outlets in Turkey that are basically wholly owned subsidiaries of the Gulen, you know, Gulen Incorporated. So there is obviously this question of, is Erdogan doing all of this because he knows that he has to do it if he wants to reorient his foreign policy? I think that that's undoubtedly part of this equation.
And that rests on another question, just which is maybe not the point, but relevant certainly. And that is this a reorientation himself based on his own political necessities? In other words, did he make so many blunders before and alienate so many sectors and empower Gulen and others so much that he realized that he had to switch his orientation geopolitically, tamp down everything, and use that as like a unifying force, you know, going forward? So he gets to sit on top of it rather than be ousted just over the contradictions that he helped to create in the country.
I think it's that. I think it's also it's complex. This picture is very complex, and there's a lot of moving parts to it. I think what you're saying is true. I think also the fact that Erdogan is undeniably is concerned about the nature of the war with the Kurds. I think that the war with the Kurds is a force that he sees as potentially destabilizing not only the country, but especially, I mean, him and his government.
Right.
And the Russians had made significant inroads with the Kurds. And Erdogan probably figures, well, if I don't do something to get back into the good graces of Putin and the Russians, I'm going to face an increasingly assertive Kurdish minority inside the country, not just the Kurds in Syria, but the Kurds in Turkey, right? And that will potentially lead to the end of my regime. I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
I think that we also need to consider that—
before you leave the Kurds, and there's also, you know, it's like a change in policy, because it seems before he wasn't afraid of stirring up what happened in Syria. Apparently he didn't consider the role that the Kurds might play in that whole thing. But he also, after he saw that, thought he was going to tamp down that possibility by besieging the Kurds in Iraq. And, you know, he had a force in there for a while until the Iraqi government forced him to take it out. And so once that was foreclosed, this whole thing was certainly lit on fire, and that may have made him reevaluate.
Yeah, I think that's true as well. And I think that just the course of events in Syria has led him to reevaluate.
Absolutely.
I mean, how could he not?
Right.
You know, it's now 2016. Now, Turkey wasn't, the most active player in 2011, I would say. But by 2012, Turkey had basically taken over as probably the dominant player in the whole Syria conflict, issue. And I think that it is critical to consider that Erdogan is conceding that he's lost Syria, he recognizes that Assad's not going anywhere, that regime change is not coming to Syria. It's not going to be a Muslim Brotherhood government under Erdogan's thumb. It's not going to be Syria as a satellite state of Turkey. And so he needs to just let that go and instead recalibrate what he's doing.
Right. I mean, he ends up this way with a successful rapprochement with Russia. Perhaps he ends up with Syria as a partner as opposed to an enemy.
I think that now obviously there's going to be bad blood with Syria over everything that Erdogan's done. But yes, I mean, ultimately, I think that what he really wants is if not directly an ally, then certainly an entity with which he can actually deal.
Right.
Right. And the Kurds, I think, figure centrally in that as well. Again, I mean, he needs somebody who's going to be able to exercise control over the Kurds, because, you know, short of an independent Kurdistan, something is going to have to be figured out here. And unfortunately for the Kurds themselves, it doesn't look like there's really any forces anywhere that are going to be backing, real independence for Kurds, at least the Kurds of Syria, who have shed a tremendous amount of blood defending themselves, defending their territory, and have eventually, you know, well, depending on how you want to look at it, but certainly have at least won the right to have some level of sovereignty over their own territory, some level of autonomous control beyond what Assad granted to them in 2012, 2013. So in any event, I think that that's one of Erdogan's considerations as well. Now, we have to also remember Turkey's economic motivations here. Without Russia as an ally, they lost not only the TurkStream pipeline, which was seen as a major infrastructure project that Turkey could get off the ground and really benefit from, and also a lucrative deal to build these nuclear reactors inside of Turkey, which was under major threat because of the icy relations between Erdogan and Putin after what happened in November, the shooting down of the Russian jet. Yep. So
they lost the season, basically.
Yeah, the tourism factor as well shouldn't be understated because Turkey is a very tourist-driven economy, one that is very much dependent on tourism. And I believe Russians are number one as far as all countries sending total number of tourists to Turkey. So, yes, I think that that was also a factor as well. But look, Erdogan would not be taking these measures if it was just about tourism and a nuclear reactor. I don't buy that at all.
No, it's the big geopolitical game, and it's his own position, of course.
Yes. And so that is essentially, how we need to read why this coup has taken place. Now, there are many theories out there that I have seen, and it's so interesting to me how, you know, in so many situations, the corporate media is so quick to say, call conspiracy theory on anything discussing false flags or anything like that, that everything is labeled conspiracy theory. Right. theory. And then this coup happens, and all of a sudden you have corporate media all through the West with many of the neocons writing op-eds in the Washington Post and in the New York Times and all over the place talking about how, no, this was not Gulen, this was most likely Erdogan's false flag, that Erdogan set this up himself so that he could carry out these political purges. Yep. Okay, now that theory is out there, and the evidence that's pointed to, conspiracy theory necessarily has to have evidence, but the indication that is leading people to that conclusion is what we mentioned earlier in our conversation, Don, that this coup, looked so poorly organized that it seemingly, was just doomed to collapse because it was just like, an amateur job,
Right. They
obviously weren't serious about carrying out a coup. This was a fake coup carried out by Erdogan's people in order to justify what he's doing. Right. Okay, I can understand that, but I don't see too much evidence backing that up an assertion.
If that's true, there's another layer of conspiracy theory, quote-unquote, with a great deal of historical analogy to support it, by the way. And that is that the U.S. supported both sides. They induced Erdogan to fake a coup, and they induced the coupsters to actually carry out a coup. And in either case, they're standing behind them.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there is another theory out there, and I will admit that this is the one. Well, I don't care. Whatever. This is the one that I think is probably the most likely, because to me, at least, just logically and based on my understanding of the facts and the situation and everything, this is the one that makes the most sense and the one that fits the evidence.
Right.
And that is that the CIA, using their ally Gulen, did attempt to carry out a coup in Turkey against Erdogan, but that Erdogan was tipped off by Russian intelligence and that he allowed the coup to go off half-cocked so that he could draw out his enemies publicly and then carry out the purges that he's carrying out. Yep. In other words, there was a real coup, but the reason it looked so poorly organized is because Erdogan knew about it beforehand thanks to Russian intelligence and was able to thwart it.
Yep.
Whether that was calling up certain generals and arm twisting them, whether that was telling them what the consequences were going to be of participating in a coup that he knew about or whatever, I believe that the coup was supposed to be much, much wider, much, much better organized, much bigger, have many more participants, and have a lot more military backing. And that a lot of that was peeled away, perhaps behind the scenes in the days and hours leading up to the coup, by Erdogan and Erdogan's people, because they knew what was coming. And the only way they knew what was coming was their own intelligence or the intelligence of another country. Now, we add to that a report that we saw in the Iranian Fars news agency. Now, let me just back up and say, I wouldn't always cite Fars as the best source, because oftentimes they've reported totally bogus information.
It's a source, though. I mean, the New York Times. It's a source. So yeah, go ahead.
No. I'm not suggesting that it's not worth reading. I'm just saying I'm not necessarily always quick to quote them for various reasons. But Fars reported, I think, 3 days after the coup, something like that, exactly what I just said, that Russian intelligence, based on their sources, okay, now we have to remember, Fars is more or less a semi-official news agency of the Iranian government,
right?
Okay, more or less. So if Fars is reporting it, that pretty much tells you that the Iranian government has more or less signed off on it.
Right. And when we're talking, actually, it's a part of the Iranian government. We're talking about the leadership council. We're talking about, you know, the Ayatollah and the grouping around him.
Yes, exactly. I think that they have an official news agency called IRNA.
Right, IRNA.
The Iranian news agency. Right. Fars is, I guess you could call it semi-official or whatever. But in any event, when you read it, you can more or less understand that you're reading at least some faction of the Iranian government's point of view. Now, they reported that Russian intelligence provided Erdogan with the information before the coup in order to thwart it. Okay, now we look at the statement from, I believe it was Dmitry Peskov, the spokesperson for Putin.
Yeah.
He didn't really deny it. Now, right. Say, yes, that's exactly what happened.
Right.
But his denial was more like a non-denial. You know what I'm saying? And to me, that at least indicates, if not entirely, that it's entirely correct, at least some level of truth to the assertion that Russian intelligence was involved. Now, you can understand why Russian intelligence would be motivated to do that, right? You can see where the benefit is in all of this. Russian intelligence knows if they help Erdogan thwart a CIA-backed coup, Erdogan is in their camp.
Let me take that a step further. That's not something that they would have told them 2 hours beforehand. That's something they would have told them perhaps before the public attempted a rapprochement.
Yes.
That might have induced it.
Yep. I agree. We don't know the timing. We can't know the timing.
Right.
But I would be willing to bet that the apology over the jet was very much connected to some kind of information that the Russians were giving to Erdogan. The Russians are pulling the levers here. I mean, they understand what leverage means in this equation. Pulling the levers is not the right word, but leveraging their position is what I mean to say. They understand the importance of Erdogan as a non-NATO, non-European entity, right? To pry him out of the orbit of NATO is to essentially change the entire geopolitical calculus of the Middle East and really of Europe. Because, I mean, that is, I mean, is there a NATO partner, a NATO member that's more critical for the United States than Turkey right now? I'm not sure there is one.
Right. You know, and I'll make reference to that meeting between Lavrov and the foreign minister of Portugal. If you look at a map, if there were some sort of a rapprochement between Portugal or some relationship between Portugal and Russia, looking at a map, that is a pretty interesting strategic position geographically.
Sure. I mean, the far west and the far east, southwest and the far southeast of Europe.
One's at the front and one's at the rear.
Yeah. Now, I don't know that Portugal necessarily is in, you know, even close to being in the same situation, because it's an EU member. So it has.
I don't know either.
But there's an awful lot of
political. There's an awful lot of political discord in Portugal. It took them forever to form a government, despite public opinion, which was clearly in favor of a left government.
Yeah, and they tried to ban the left government outright.
That's right. And yeah. So you have that going on, and this interim government, if that's what it is, trying to stand on something. And you have also some of the statements that were made by the foreign minister about the global geopolitical situation were fairly remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, the Russians smell blood, yep. You know, as far yep. as the EU goes and as yep. far as, you know, foreign policy from the West goes. So, yes, I think that I personally would agree that Russian intelligence was likely involved here.
Yep.
I think that Russian intelligence was, you know, and again, that report to me is very plausible. Now, we don't know. We can't say for certain.
Right.
But that to me explains why the coup looked the way that it did. Because yep. if you look at the history of military coups in Turkey, you know, in the, you know, 1960s, 70s, and especially the September 12th, 1980 coup, in Turkey, those show you that, you know, when the US and the CIA are backing a coup, they know how to do it. They know what it's supposed to look like. I mean, in Turkey. And what happened in 2016 did not look like that. So that leaves us with, did Erdogan stage it himself in a very sort of obviously poorly executed false flag? Or was there a tip-off to Erdogan beforehand that allowed him to neutralize the majority of the coup plotters?
There's another possibility, or it may just support one, particularly the latter. And that is that if you were to poll, say, the military leadership, that in terms of their view of the geopolitical situation, they lean more towards Russia or in any event, towards supporting Erdogan through this process, just naturally, than they do following the course that they were following before. And it may be that part of his calculus was that fact, that my military advisors in the main are telling me this contradictory thing to what I've been doing, and what I've been doing is a mess.
Maybe. Although I don't know that we don't know necessarily, certainly not with any, you know, hard evidence.
Not any
the extent
evidence.
the extent to which the military has shifted, right? The military right. is historically, I mean, that's the Turkish deep state,
right?
Right. The military is in bed with Washington and has been for decades.
Forever.
So is that still the case? I mean, this is the question you're really raising. Is that still the case, or has that changed? And if it has changed, then I certainly take your point. Although, you know, I don't know. I don't know that we can say that for certain.
If I'm in the military, let's just say this. I mean, this could have started catalyzing last November. If I'm in the military and the theory of, you know, how we conduct war with Russia and all that stuff looks good on paper and, you know, fits into classic military strategy, whatever, fine. When suddenly you shoot down a Russian plane and realize that the retaliation that you have to prepare for might affect all of your military bases, that's an entirely different reality that might make you recalculate.
Yes, absolutely. And I've heard another possibility floated out there as well, that the military forces that shot down the Russian jet may not have been loyal to Erdogan.
Yeah.
That they may have been U.S., you know, U.S. allied elements of the Turkish military that did that.
Yeah.
Erdogan, obviously, back in November, couldn't publicly acknowledge that elements of his military don't actually answer to him.
Right.
And so he didn't say anything about it at the time.
Nobody would want him to do that. Even the Russians would tell him not to do that. Just the public relations aspect of saying we had a rogue military element shoot down a Russian plane would scare the hell out of everybody on the planet.
Of course. So it's another possibility that and I think this was actually stated, if not by Erdogan, then by one of his deputies, that potentially that Russian jet may have actually been shot down by forces that were not answering to Erdogan at all.
It's a possibility.
So, you know, there is that possibility as well. And that would make some sense, although that would then raise the question. So was all of this Russian-Turkish, you know, conflict over these last 9 months kind of for show? Did the Russians know that the Turkish forces that shot down their jet were not Erdogan's force? You know, again, I don't know. This
that
is
gets
total
a little too crazy for me. I mean, it's quite possible. We could get even crazier. Perhaps the Russians engineered all of this themselves. I mean, I doubt it. But I mean, while we are swimming in, you know, the seas of possibility, and obviously by its nature, not much evidence. You know, these things are plausible, and the thing that you're saying makes the most sense in terms of fitting the narrative to the facts.
Yeah, and again, I think, you know, and in my article, I hope people will read it, because I go into some detail about what happened in 1980, because I think that is relevant, because it connects to Gladio, you know, the NATO stay behind operations, the Gladio, you know, control terrorism, strategy of tension in Europe in the 1970s, you know, the stoking of far right wing fascist terrorism for the purposes of, you know, essentially pushing forward the U.S. agenda, that is, you know, and in Turkey, we historically, you know, the Gray Wolves and their organization and other organizations as well. You know, there is this very long sort of history of the use of, you know, fascist mobs and fascist organizations and terrorism in order to be able to carry out these type of operations. Right. Now, that is where you run into the hand of the CIA in all of this, because, yeah, you know, the CIA was the instrumental force behind the coup in 1980, and it was actually a quite similar situation. You had a government come to power that was willing to make certain concessions towards factions of political Islam. They were willing to sort of move away from, I guess, what you could call the sort of militant secularism of the Kemalist faction and so forth. So, you know, that all happened against the backdrop of the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And then, you know, just months later, you have this coup in Turkey, and Zbigniew Brzezinski,
who also had stopped off in Afghanistan.
Well, exactly. Well, yeah. Zbigniew Brzezinski, we know what he did in Afghanistan, organizing the Mujahideen. But Zbigniew Brzezinski gets, and what's the guy's name? Paul? I forget. Anyway, he gets a guy to be on the National Security Council, basically the number one man in charge of the Turkey, you know, Middle East, you know, region, specifically Turkey, for the National Security Council, a guy named, was his first name Paul? I'm forgetting now. Anyway, his last name, Henze, right? Henze. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Henze had a career in the CIA going back to basically when it was founded in the Dulles days in the early 1950s. Late 40s, but early 1950s is when he comes on board. And he is all over the world. He's in Ethiopia. He's in the Far East. He's everywhere. But his main focus in the mid 70s and late 70s is in Turkey. He is the station chief for the CIA in Turkey. 1974 to 1977. He is the one who is orchestrating the fascist groups, the Gray Wolves and others, and the terror operations. And then he is then brought over by Zbigniew Brzezinski to be one of the main figures in the National Security Council under President Carter by 1976, when Carter is elected. So he comes back to Washington. Now, he is sitting there on the National Security Council. His boss is Zbigniew Brzezinski. And in the coup happens in Turkey in 1980. And Carter, this is the story goes, Carter picks up the phone, talks to Henze, and Henze famously says, "Our boys have done it." That's what he said. That's the phrase he used. That's been reported in many different places, including books written on the subject. "Our boys have done it." That the coup of 1980 was orchestrated by Henze and the CIA, and it was carried out successfully. Okay, that is the model. That is the historical precedent for what we've just seen in Turkey. But the difference is today, it failed. And I think that there has to be a reason why the CIA failed where they've been successful so many times before. And I think that this idea that Russian intelligence fed the information to Erdogan first is quite plausible indeed.
We've got about 2 minutes left. Maybe you could just do a little prognostication.
Yes, I think that what we're going to see is that Turkey is going to go through this very, very bloody and very brutal political purge that's going to be ongoing. I think a lot more people are going to get killed. A lot of people are going to get disappeared. A lot of Gulenists are going to find themselves, if they're lucky, fleeing the country. If they're unlucky, making their way to an early grave. I think that Erdogan's power is consolidated significantly. But I think that all of that's probably pretty obvious. On the international scene, I think that Turkey has now, like I said, crossed the Rubicon. That means that Turkey has a couple of things that they're going to have to do. Turkey is going to have to improve its relations with Iran. I think that's pretty clear, and I think that that's exactly what's indicated from the Iranian government, including Foreign Minister Zarif, when he tweeted some pretty strong words of support for Erdogan. I think that means that Turkey is going to have to go back to some of the non-Western deals they were making a few years ago. Remember, Turkey was a purchaser of not NATO and U.S. missiles, but Chinese missiles. And then they reneged on that deal once they had this falling out and moved back towards the West. I think they're going to have to go back to that. They're going to have to go back to China and try to get those missile systems from them. They're going to have to go back to Russia to buy more military hardware. They're going to have to reestablish these economic ties with Russia. They're going to have to expand their economic engagement with China. Can Turkey now become a node of the One Belt, One Road, New Silk Road strategy? Seems to me it's a perfect candidate for exactly that. If China is expanding all through Central Asia, well, those are Turkic peoples. Turkey has a tremendous amount of influence in Central Asia, and Turkey is geographically, as we all know, the bridge between Asia and Europe, which is ultimately what the One Belt, One Road strategy is all about. So for Russia, for China, for Iran, Turkey is now a major player and a major prize. Erdogan knows it, and that is what I think is going to truly guide Turkish foreign policy in the months and years to come, at least as long as Erdogan and his faction are in power, which, based on what we've seen now, will be for the foreseeable future.
Next week when we pick this up, I want to pick it up on one particularly interesting part of that, which is a rapprochement between Iran and what is essentially a Muslim Brotherhood government, because that could have fallout throughout the remainder of Muslim Brotherhood land. We'll talk about that next week.
Sure.
Okay, Eric, thanks a lot. A pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.